Welcome to the season finale of Under the Shell, presented by Terrapin Sports Central. To end off this year, we have our most anticipated guest yet, Gary Williams. I'm Brennan Wiesel.
Sam Jane.
Michael Big Mike Howes.
And this is Under the Shell.
Our next guest is a member of the Basketball Hall of Fame, the College Basketball Hall of Fame, a two-time ACC Coach of the Year, a national champion, and arguably the biggest figure in Maryland athletics. We are so honored to have on Coach Gary Williams.
Obviously, Coach, you played for 3 years here at Maryland, and then you decided to, you know, get into coaching. Was there anything in particular that made you want to get into it? Was there a person or a coach that really kind of brought you into the industry, or was it just kind of a natural transition for you?
Well, I loved playing basketball, and really, I wasn't ready to give up the sport. I mean, I wasn't good enough to play professionally after college, so I knew that it was either coaching or a referee, and certainly didn't want to be a referee, that's for sure. But I had a good high school coach, and I think a lot of anybody that played high school basketball, that has a lot to do with how you feel about the game sometimes, because my high school coach was more of a father figure to me, and I just looked at coaching as I thought about him. And you know, it was something that I wanted to try after I graduated from Maryland. I graduated from the business school, but I really didn't see going into the business field at that time.
I was doing some research, and I was looking up your college basketball stats, and it said you only played 3 seasons at Maryland. Was there a story behind why you only played?
Yeah, freshmen weren't eligible to play up until about, I think it was 83 or 84, where they allowed freshmen to play. It was really a good rule. I mean, you couldn't have it now with Title IX because the expenses of, you know, freshman coaches in every sport and things like that would just be prohibitive. But back then, you got to know your teammates, obviously, as freshmen, but you also would draw crowds. A lot of, you know, we had a good freshman team. I think we were 15-1 or 16-1, something like that. And the crowds would come to the freshman game, and some people would leave after, you know, they saw the freshman play in state for the varsity game.
So then, kind of following up on that, what made you decide to come coach at Maryland? You were at Ohio State for a good 3 years, had a winning record all 3 years, and then you decide to leave and join the ACC, a pretty good conference in Maryland. What's the story behind that?
Well, Ohio State was a great job. It's probably, in terms of budgets, administratively, things like that, it was probably the best job I had, but I had played basketball at Maryland, had graduated from there, and I guess the lure of coming back to your school, very few coaches ever get that opportunity to coach at the school they went to undergrad at, so I took on the responsibility, and it was a lot of responsibility. Things weren't great when I got the job, and I had second thoughts, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, you mentioned some of those second thoughts. You're coming in kind of after some of the Len Bias stuff and, you know, maybe some possible sanctions, and you kind of get some of those sanctions from the NCAA. So what was that like coming in, being a coach, and then having, you know, repercussions for stuff that you necessarily didn't do?
Well, it's horrible. You know, you take responsibility for what you do. I had nothing to do with what was going on, and I really didn't know the seriousness of the situation in Maryland. The NCAA investigators said, first year and the week of the ACC tournament, they come out with, no NCAA tournament, no live TV. And, you know, if you play in the ACC, players go there for those two things. I mean, that's why they want to go to school. So recruiting became very difficult, and we had to fight our way out. And it was not an easy fight. At that time, Carolina and Duke were winning national championships on a pretty regular basis. You know, that's who we had to be as good as. So it was a tough uphill battle.
A lot of it I've seen has been credited to Walt Williams for kind of getting you through that era of Maryland basketball. What was so special about him, or how was he able to kind of drag you guys out of the depths of where you were at?
Well, he was a great player, first of all. I think he was sixth as a lottery pick his senior year. But Walt did everything right, both on and off the court. In terms of his playing ability, he could play 4 positions. He could play anywhere from point guard to power forward at that 6'8 size. And, you know, that certainly helped because you could do different things with him offensively, because teams obviously you know, came after him, tried to shut him down first. And, but Walt was just, his nickname was the Wizard. And it was because of the way he played, but also he had this, the way he moved on the court, you know, it was just such a smooth looking thing. And it was hard to believe. He still has the record in the ACC, which the ACC won't talk about now, but he still has the record of 8 consecutive games scoring 30 points or more. And on our team, I think Walt averaged like 24, 25. We didn't have a lot of other scoring. And, you know, teams are really focused on him. And for him to do that, I think kind of shows how great a player he was. But the other part was off the court. He was just tremendous. Students just liked him. You know, he's one of those guys that always had time for people and talked to everybody. And in fact, when he was playing in the NBA, I think he played 11 or 12 years in the NBA, he gave back a scholarship to the University of Maryland. So very few players have done that. And, you know, Walt does the radio now. He's a color commentator on the radio for the Maryland basketball games.
It kind of is interesting, I think, because, you know, he was already on the, I think he came here in 88, and then 89 was when you were hired. It feels as if today, maybe when all these sanctions are being laid down, the transfer portal would have probably been where he would have gone. Do you think that something like that could happen again in today's era of college basketball, where like a holdover from a previous era kind of helps bring someone out, even if they're dealing with, you know, pretty tough sanctions?
Yeah, probably not, you know, just being realistic. But the thing with Walt, he could have transferred right away. When you receive sanctions from the NCAA, your players can transfer without having to sit out a year. So he could have gone even back then. But Walt's from Temple Hills, his parents got to see him play every home game. And that was very important to Walt, that they could see him play. And Walt enjoyed playing basketball. I think that was the key. He knew his status at Maryland. I mean, there's been nobody bigger than Walt Williams. It didn't get as much attention, obviously, because we couldn't play the NCAA. We couldn't play, on live TV. But that first year, Walt's sophomore year, we beat Carolina twice and won at Southern California. We would have been an NCAA team, but, you know, that's being investigated. NCAA has a way of not picking you to go to the NCAA tournament.
I guess he didn't have to worry about his parents not being able to see him on TV if they could just come and watch the games.
Right. I mean, that was big for Walt. It really was.
So then kind of moving on to your coaching style, most coaches have a coach themselves that they say they would like model their leadership or coaching style for. Who would that coach be for you?
Well, the person I learned the most from was Tom Davis. He got me, and I was a high school coach in New Jersey. And he became the head coach at Lafayette College in Pennsylvania. And he called me up. He had been getting his doctorate at Maryland while I was playing, and we got to know each other. And he gave me the opportunity to coach in college as an assistant coach. And he was a great teacher. You know, you learn how to teach. I learned how to teach from him and the way he taught. He was a great coach. He went to Boston College from Lafayette, then he was at Stanford, then he was at Iowa, and very successful as a coach. And so you learn some things. We were strictly man-to-man when I played in Maryland. He was a zone coach. I learned zone pressure. I learned how to attack zones offensively, things like that from him. And I think as a coach, what you have to do is you steal from everybody that you see something that can help the way you think you'd like to play. You don't change the way you play, but you kind of bring whatever you're going to take from that coach into your system and try to keep getting better every year.
Where did you model your flex offense from? Was that something you learned from another coach? Was that something you just kind of learned yourself from watching basketball? Where did your flex offense come?
Well, when I was in college, we ran a very deliberate offense. It was probably Pete Newell, longtime coach of California, a very good assistant coach with the pros. It was called reverse action, and very similar to the flex in terms of swinging the ball, you know, getting it side to side in the offense. And Tom Davis ran some flex, so I picked up from him some things to use. And then we did it too. And flex is a very it would be called old fashioned now. You still see it in transition sometimes in the NBA, but what we did, we used that as our basis, and then we looked to score off of different things. Like we had a Walt Williams, for example, we would run certain things for Walt out of the flex offense, and then as time went by, as Steve Francis and Joe Smith, people like that, certainly Juan Dixon, Gravis Vasquez, we would run special things for them because they all could do certain things, and he didn't want to take away from their game by just sticking them into my offense, because I like my offense so much, I was going to make them do exactly what I wanted to do. But so you take advantage of talent that you do have. And, you know, we were fortunate to have some great players along the way that, because you can score a lot of ways. You get to the free throw line, you steal the ball, you score in transition. It's not just your half court offense that makes you a high scoring team.
We talked to James Gist as well on this podcast a couple months ago, and he was talking to us about some of the assistant coaches you brought in and how they were, you know, very good at firing people up in practice. So what did you look for when bringing in assistant coaches?
Well, nowadays it looks like assistant coaches have one job, is to recruit. It was different back then. You were kind of trying to mold your assistant coach, give them, in other words, I was an assistant coach for 7 years in college. And my coach helped me get my first head coaching job at American University. So that always felt that was my job, to try to help guys get head coaching positions. And, you know, we were fortunate that most of our assistants did wind up being head coaches at some point in their career.
I read a story or heard something about how you were talking about, you know, college basketball. We know there's a lot of, you know, stuff that goes on in terms of dealing with coaches who maybe don't have the same ethics as others do. And it's kind of an unlevel playing field. We've seen the NCAA hand out sanctions before, and you talked about it. What was it like going against coaches or programs that you knew maybe were doing things a little bit differently or shady? And how did you kind of deal with that in terms of still having to recruit and play against them? What was that like?
Well, I didn't particularly like it, that's for sure. Especially if you got beat. If you got beat by a player that you know the other coach cheated on to get, that wasn't my idea of a good time. But, you did it your way, whatever way you thought it. You know, you have to remember, I came in after a coach was fired for NCAA violations. So I wasn't going to turn around and do anything to hurt the school once again, because that was a low point for Maryland for a lot of reasons, not just the basketball, but what happened with Len Bias was all within a 3-year period. And so we had to overcome all those things. So I wasn't going to do anything to jeopardize our chances to get good again, because Maryland did have a good basketball tradition up until that time. So that was my goal coming in here. But, you know, nowadays with the NIL and the transfer portal, what was illegal is legal now. In other words, you can pay players now. And that's what's going on with every major college school. And the rules have changed. And so now, if I was coaching, I'd have to figure out a way to raise money, to help raise money, to put together a collective that could keep Maryland competitive on a national basis in terms of what is being paid to some of these players now.
Kind of moving on to another interesting topic, Cole Fieldhouse. There's many stories told about the atmosphere of Cole, how hard it was to play there. For someone like me who never got to experience it, kind of what was it like coaching in Cole Fieldhouse?
It was the best. It was the most feared place to play in the ACC. But, I mean, there was tough gyms. I mean, Cameron and Duke is, you know, always going to be a tough place to play. NC State had a very tough place, old Reynolds Coliseum. Clemson was, you know, just crazy because the fans there were basically football fans, but they came to the basketball games, you know, got all excited when they saw the ball go through the net anyway. But so there was great places to play. But Cole was interesting because it was built in the 50s. It was the best, one of the best on campus arenas at that time, 2 Final Fours, several regionals during that time up until, we left in 2002 to go to Xfinity. And so Cole was you go in there in January, it was cold in there. By halftime, it was 100 degrees. You know, the body heat of the people there. We get 14,000 in there, and just the way the roof was in Cole Fieldhouse, and you can still see it a little bit but now that it's a football practice facility, but the noise would just roll right around that arena. When you had 4,000 students sitting right behind the benches at the two schools, then it was just an incredible atmosphere and crazy. You know, it was just nuts in there. And, you know, we won a lot of games there in terms of, I thought our conditioning, what was maybe used to the fact that it would get so hot there in the second half that we could handle that a little better. And of course, our crowd, you know, they wouldn't let us die. You know, they just stayed in the game. And it was a great viewing. It was a bowl arena. There was no poles. There was no second deck. There was just one big bowl. And we could get 14,000 in there for the games.
What was your reaction when they announced they were building Xfinity? And how does it compare to Cole?
Well, Xfinity was, Cole was old. I mean, it had gotten old. The very poor restroom facilities, locker rooms were bad, you know, all those things. So we looked at whether to redo Cole or to build a new place. And the problem was Cole was built, you know, in the 50s when asbestos was considered okay, you know, to put in for insulation, things like that. So it would have cost like $75 million back in 2002, or it just started, I guess, in 99 to build, to redo Cole. And a new arena, it was about 120, I think it was $120 million to build Xfinity. And, you know, so it was a logical choice, but boy, we hated to leave Cole because it was a tremendous home court advantage. You know, it was one of the older places that was still a great place to play basketball.
Maryland basketball, like you said, obviously not in Cole anymore. So what was your favorite moment from Cole Fieldhouse?
Well, there was a couple for sure. I think in 94, our first good team, we had Joe Smith, Keith Booth, Dwayne Simpkins, who's just become the head coach at American U, Johnny Rhodes, all-time steals leader in the ACC, and the X-ray hip. And we started two freshmen and three sophomores. And that year we went undefeated at home. We beat Carolina when they were number one in the country. And that was really an exciting team. You know, we had no fear. Maybe we were too young to have any fear, but we had no fear. We just went after everybody and to go undefeated there. I still have a picture right here in my office of the crowd storming the court after we beat Carolina that night. And it's just, it was one of those special things. And then, the last game ever played in Cole was against Virginia. Virginia had a good team, and the score was like we went over 100. I mean, we were really – that was the year we won the national championship. We were just good, and we went over 100, and Virginia had like – I think they had 90 or something like that. And it just – we had invited all the former players, the living former players back, and we had most of those players back, and it was just a great day for everybody. And it was tough to leave Cole. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, but you the thing you have a lot of memories of what a great place it was.
We talked to one of the current football strength coach, and he was telling us a funny story about how when they first got there, they had like buckets. You were talking about the leakage for the water that would
oh, yeah,
down and stuff like that. Do you have any like anecdotes like that or anything funny where Cole just, you could kind of tell it was like, this is a legendary place, but it, you know, it's getting kind of old and stuff like that.
We were playing Duke. I think it was right after 94 because, you know, we were pretty good after that. And the commissioner of the ACC was at the game, Fred Bearcat, back then. And he called Mike Krzyzewski and myself into a meeting in the hallway outside of our locker rooms before the game. There was a thunderstorm going on. And the lights had flickered a couple of times. So we had to make plans just in case the lights went out, what we were going to do to make up the game and all that. And I remember Krzyzewski looking at me like, you know, what the hell is this? You know, like, you know, you guys, here you go again in Cole Fieldhouse, you know, because all that rep would be a little different. And everything went okay that night. But, you know, and there were leaks. You know, the roof was old. It would leak once in a while. And you had to be careful there weren't any wet spots on the floor. But, you know, overall, that building, you know, the university got their money out of that building. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about, you talked about the 2002 team, obviously scoring 100 against Virginia, very high scoring team, ranked in the top 10 offensively, maybe wasn't as good defensively. And that tournament run, you guys averaged 87.4 points up until the national championship game. Then it was super low scoring against Indiana. Were you worried as a coach that maybe Indiana was going to drag you into their style, or why was that game more low scoring? Is that just the nerves of the national championship? Like, take me through why maybe that game was different than all the rest.
Well, first of all, we had to beat, we beat Kentucky, Connecticut, Kansas, and Indiana to win it. So we beat every blue blood there was in the country at that time to win it. I'm very proud of that. Our toughest game, I thought, would be Connecticut. It was. I remember Jim Calhoun, I talked to him after the game, who was the coach of Connecticut. He told his team at halftime, whoever won that game was going to win the national championship. And he was right. Kansas had been ranked, Roy Williams was coaching in Kansas, the former North Carolina coach. And they had been ranked number, we were never ranked number one in the country that whole year. And the Kansas had been like 6 weeks or something like that. And we got down, I think, 13-3 against Kansas in that semifinal game. And then we outscored them like 45-20 in the mid part of that game. And that's probably the best basketball, you know, we played in the NCAA tournament that year. So beating Kansas, I don't know if we relaxed a little bit or whatever, because we knew we were better than Indiana. I mean, Indiana, Oklahoma had upset Duke. Indiana had upset Oklahoma, and all of a sudden we're playing Indiana. And I think that caught us off guard a little bit. Maybe we didn't, you know, respect it, even though it's a national championship game, players are players, you know. You really worry about that, making sure they respect their opponent and things like that. But Indiana did a good job of slowing us down. But, you know, we gave them a three at the buzzer. You know, the game was over. We would have won that game by double figures. I think we won it by 9 or whatever it was. I think we were nervous. We had trouble scoring, and you know, we get to a point where you start thinking something's wrong. And I think we went through that stage, and you know, I remember Juan Dixon really brought us back in that game, and Byron Muchon, another very good player in that team, made some really big defensive players for us. And you know, we were deep. We were 9 deep. We played 9 without any problem. And you know, our second team could compete with the first team in practice, and that's, you know, how you get better during the season when your second team could really push the first team.
Star of that national championship team, obviously, Juan has a very, you know, incredible story. Both his parents, I know, passed from, I think it was AIDS-related illnesses, and they were, you know, hair addicts. What was it like recruiting him? You know, how were you able, what was his character? How was he able to kind of persevere through that? Is that one of the more, just tell me about Juan and what he was like.
Well, Juan went to Calvert Hall in Baltimore. He was put there by his, he had relatives that could afford to put him there in school. And Juan was very shy. I think you go within yourself when tough things happen. And Juan was going through that period. Juan was about 6'2", 150 in high school. And he was a shooting guard. He wasn't a point guard. So a lot of people stayed away from him because he didn't handle the ball particularly well in high school. But I just thought, you know, I had coached a couple of Baltimore guys by then, and I knew how tough they were. And I thought, Juan, and anybody can score. You know, I kind of liked, you know, last time I checked, the idea is to put the ball in the basket, and Juan could do that, you know. So, yeah, I'll never forget when we signed Juan, the Baltimore Sun came out and said we really made a mistake, wasn't big enough to play in ACC and all this. Well, while Juan wound up ACC Player of the Year, National Player of the Year, MVP of the Final Four, all-time leading scorer of Maryland, accomplished more than any player ever accomplished at Maryland in terms of team wins and things like that. And so we were talking about it after the national championship. I'll never forget this, in the back of Cole Fieldhouse. They had a celebration the day after, and it was over. We were back in the locker room, and I was talking to Juan, and I reminded him that he pulled out his wallet and he pulled out the article from the Baltimore Sun that told, that said he couldn't play in the ACC. So it's things come around sometime.
Yeah, there's nothing like some good bulletin board material like that that you can keep in the back of your pocket and then prove them all wrong.
In your wallet, not the back of the pocket, apparently.
Yeah, we had wallets back then. We had cameras, too.
You stopped coaching over 10 years ago, but you're still involved in the Maryland Athletic Department. You still show up to so many Maryland Athletic events. Why is that? What keeps you coming back? What keeps you still working for the university?
Well, I still work for the school, so I try to be a little bit visible in that. I really like the new coach. Kevin Willard's done a great job. His teams play aggressively. His style of play, as he gets his players into the program, I think will allow him to be very successful. So I do whatever I can to help with the program, but stay away, you know, if you know what I mean. I don't want to be hanging around the gym or anything like that. But, you know, it's great to see the enthusiasm back in Maryland basketball and, you know, going undefeated at home in the Big Ten this year, this past season. You know, it was a great accomplishment. And, you know, getting that NCAA win in Kevin's first year is, I thought, was really important. And so I think we're in good shape. And, you know, nowadays with the transfer portal and the NIL, your team's going to be different every year. And so it's going to be interesting. You know, your ability to put together a team now becomes almost more important than building a team, if you know what I mean, because like the championship team we had all juniors and seniors. We had no McDonald's All-Americans, but we had all juniors and seniors. And, you know, with juniors and seniors that are good players, I'll play anybody because of their experience. You got guys 22, 23 years old playing against some hotshot freshman that's 18 years old. I'll take the old guys, you know, and we'll go play. And that's what we were. But nowadays things change, you know, and then now you have to adjust to that. And you know, the good thing now is you get to practice in the summer. We couldn't practice in the summer when I was coach, but you can go, I think starting late June, you can go right through to August and really get a good feel for your team before the school year actually starts.
Last question from us. When you talked about it now in the Big Ten, obviously, when you saw the news, or I'm sure you've heard it through back channels, that Maryland was moving to the Big Ten, what was your reaction? I'm sure that as a longtime ACC coach, that's something that probably you weren't really envisioning. Do you like it? Did you not like it? Like, what was that? What was your reaction?
Well, the reason was we were $20 million in debt in the athletic department. I mean, let's be honest. You know, it's finances. And expansion was becoming a big part of college sports. You look at the Big Ten now taking UCLA and Southern Cal, for example, into the Big Ten. I think 2024, they come in. And while we were leaving and going to the Big Ten, the ACC was kind of breaking up the Big East, taking Virginia Tech, and they had already taken Boston College and Miami and some old Big East schools. And so we took a lot of heat for leaving the ACC, but the ACC never took the heat they deserved for basically breaking up the Big East in terms of their football schools, Syracuse, you know, schools like that. So it was just part of the deal, but we did it financially, and really, when you look at it academically, you're looking at very similar universities to Maryland, more so than the ACC, large state universities, for the most part, in the Big Ten. And sure, there was rivalries, but there was no football rivalry. You know, people talk about rivalries. Okay, what was a football rivalry? There's this pause, you know, where they can't think of any because there wasn't any. And basketball was Duke and Carolina. And that's all people talked about was they didn't say, oh, we're really going to miss playing Clemson. You know, they didn't say that. It was just Duke and Carolina. So that's the reason. And, you know, people don't like change. You know, most people don't like change. It was fun to go on to the ACC basketball games. And that's the way it was. But here we are, you know, and now you go from here and the Big Ten has become a dominant conference along with the Southeast conference in terms of finances for the schools. Every school is going to get a ton of money starting next year. I think it'll be over, you know, well over $80 million each school in the Big Ten will get. and that money can be used for a lot of things. So, you know, except for rivalries, I think it's a very positive thing where we are now. And if you look at the ACC right now, you know, football, you know, what's going to happen with, say, Florida State, Clemson, are they going to stay in the ACC? Basketball is different now because you don't play everybody twice. Back when I was coaching, you played everybody twice. So there was no doubt who the best team was every year in the ACC. So, you know, this is 2023, and here we are.
Lastly, our last segment for you, we do this with every guest, just rapid fire. I'm going to ask you a question. Just give us your best response. So first question is the favorite player you've ever coached.
That's not fair. I mean, I coached guys at other places too that were great, but you know, Walt Williams, Gravis Vasquez, I'll throw those two out there as just examples of guys I really like, but there's a ton of them.
Most underrated player you ever coached?
Most underrated was probably Byron Mouton at Maryland and Steve Blake. Steve Blake averaged 9 points a game in college, played 13 years in the NBA.
Your favorite post-game snack?
Post-game snack? You'd eat late. Most of the games are at night. Probably pizza. It was very healthy, though.
The hardest place to play in the ACC other than Cole?
Well, it was Duke, but part of that is because they were so good. I mean, they had Grant Hill, Christian Leitner, Hurley, all those guys. I mean, that's a glorified high school gym. It seats like 8,500. But when they're good, that becomes a very difficult place to play.
What was the worst opposing locker room you ever visited?
Worst opposing locker room. Well, I can't talk about that because we had bad locker rooms in Colt Fieldhouse. Overseas we played in the, you know, I took some teams overseas. You should have seen those locker rooms. Like, let's put it this way, the plumbing wasn't working in a few of them.
Your favorite sports movie?
Favorite sports movie? It's got to be Hoosiers, you know, just because I was connected with basketball. But that was, you know, basically a true story and, you know, incredible. And, you know, you talk about changes and, you know, changing leagues and everything. Back then, there was one champion in this whole state of Indiana, and that's a basketball, high school basketball crazy state. And for a small school to win that championship against the city schools was just a tremendous accomplishment.
What was the ACC rival you enjoyed beating the most?
Well, you want to beat the best team, so it was Duke of Carolina. We had some great games at both those schools. We were able to beat them when they were number one in the country a couple of times, and you know that certainly gives you a feeling of satisfaction. You know, it's funny, those two schools, like when I got the job, we were going through all those tough things. That's who you pointed at. You wanted to get as good as they were. In other words, you didn't have, you know, it was daunting. If you looked at it, you had to overcome, like, we were at the bottom of the league, and you had to overcome, you know, 8 really good schools. Well, we just picked those two and tried to get as good as they were somehow. And, you know, that I think that really helped us get through things.
I asked about your favorite player you coached. What about the hardest player you coached against?
I'll tell you who was really good and who everybody didn't like was Christian Leitner, because he was 6'9", could handle the ball. He could bring it up against pressure if he had to. Very good shooter, knew the game, great passer. And, you know, a funny thing about Christian Leitner, I remember playing him at Colt Fieldhouse. This was like 91, the year they won the national championship. Game's going on, and Leitner and Hurley come by the bench. They're yelling at each other. They're arguing during the game because probably didn't give Leitner the ball or something, you know, during a game. They're just calling each other names, you know, as they're running up the court as the game's going on. But, you know, they competed. They were really good. Grant Hill was on that team also.
Who was the funniest player or joker you had on your team?
Oh, that was Gravis Vasquez. He was, there was no guy who liked practice better than Gravis. He just loved playing basketball, and he thought it was great. He grew up on having to play outdoors in Venezuela. They didn't have access to gyms where he grew up, very poor area. And so eventually caught up with him because he played the NBA for 6 years. And at the end of his NBA stint, he had basically, he was bone on bone in his one ankle. You know, there was just nothing there. And the pounding of the concrete got to him, but he was just so appreciative of everything. And he kept practice loose, you know, and he was loose in the games too. You know, he took some shots that you just kind of shook your head, but he was a great player.
Your favorite win other than the national championship?
We beat Georgetown in the Capitol Center when Joe Smith and Keith Booth were freshmen, and Johnny Rose, X-Ray Hip, and Dwayne Simpkins were sophomores. And that game got us going. We went from winning three games in the ACC the year before to the Sweet 16 that year. And those guys really had a lot of toughness to, you know, with a very young team to be able to do things like that.
And then last question here, would Gary Williams, the coach, have recruited Gary Williams, the player?
Not as a starter, but in other words, part of a good team is the guys on the bench that are willing to really work hard every day in practice to make the starters better. And I would have been a good seventh, eighth man. But back then I started because I knew what the coach wanted and I knew how to play. But I just wasn't talented enough to be, you know, a great player today. But, you know, I would have been good to have on the team.
Well, bring Coach, the intangibles, Coach.
Which I
said, you bring the intangibles.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd have that. Yeah, I'd be one of those guys who are timeouts who would clap when the team
came forward. You wouldn't average a lot of points, but you'd average a lot of hand claps.
Yeah, that always amazes me. Those guys, they're going to get hurt now. You see how they run out on the court now with timeouts? You know, the assistant coaches are making the players do that. They go, hey, you guys got to show emotion when they, you know, during your timeout. Yeah. Our guys, you know, back when I was playing, guys hope to trip so they get in the game if you got hurt. I'm going off the court.
Yeah, I always think that. I'm like, how are they so, like, excited that the, you know, like.
They're not. They're made to do that. I'm telling you.
Manufactured energy.
Sure. Got to watch those guys that clap a lot. They're not always, you know, I'd rather have a guy that didn't do anything but played really hard every time he was on the court.
That's all I got. I don't know if Mike and any of them, but we're really appreciative of you coming on. Obviously, that was a great time. Thank you for all the really cool stories and your perspective. So appreciate you hopping on with us.
Thanks, you guys. Good luck with it, okay?
And that was another great interview by the Under the Shell boys. Gary Williams, a lot of fun stories, great rapid fire round, but now we are going to talk about sports. And we're going to a pair of teams that both fell in the Big Ten tournament this week. Lacrosse, the women's team fell 14-9 to number 1 Northwestern, while the men's team lost 14-5 to number 15 Michigan. Now both will shift their focus to the NCAA tournament. Brendan, what did you see?
Brendan, you were at attendance for the men's side, so let's talk about them first. Kind of a huge program upset. I mean, to lose to Michigan in Michigan's first Big Ten tournament title ever. Pretty impressive win for the Wolverines and a pretty disappointing loss. What did you see from Tillman's squad?
Yeah, I had my eyes on both games, both letting up 14 goals. The men's game was obviously first. I was in the crowd there. Michigan, way fewer people in attendance, but God, they had so much energy. I mean, Michigan, the game was tied 2-2, and after that, I think Michigan scored like three straight goals, and then after that, they just never looked back. Maryland couldn't, and they could win faceoffs, but they just, in the offensive possession, no good shots. They would get it down to end of the shot clock. They scored one end of the shot clock goal, which I was like, well, Maryland really hadn't done that all year, so I was surprised to see that. And then they just didn't score.
Yeah.
And they scored one more goal after that.
The offense just looked so stagnant. I mean, I was watching some of it, and it just looked like it was a lot of side-to-side movement rather than, you know, pushing it down the field, making sure that you're putting pressure on the back line of Michigan's defense. Instead, it seemed like they were just kind of not really in the flow of the game. And then it just really fell apart in that, you know, in that second half.
Yeah, all year when they'd gone down by three or so goals, they'd lost. But then the Johns Hopkins game, go down by three early and have a roaring comeback. So I thought maybe we would see a very similar thing happen where Maryland would go down, same field, same location, whatever, you know, same exact maybe story from 3 days earlier.
Right.
But go down and you get too desperate, and Michigan's just a much stronger team than Johns Hopkins. At least they have against Maryland all year. I mean, I said it at the beginning, when Maryland played Michigan earlier in the year, they had never lost to them. And then now they've done it twice. So it's just very clear that Michigan wants to win that and has their number.
Yeah, clearly. I mean, I think that another thing when you can look at is this team, I mean, Tillman talked about the difference between them and last year's team. I think maybe, not to say that the pressure got to them, but in a title game, when you fall behind and you already use so much gas to come back and beat Hopkins, it almost felt like maybe they just kind of ran out of fuel in the tank almost. It seemed as if towards the end there, it was tired legs. It looked like they weren't really able to make a final push. And I mean, when a team has that advantage over you already, and then they get ahead, like how Michigan did, they can kind of just ride that wave to a victory.
It's a big mentality thing too. You know, Maryland's won so many Big Ten championships or conference championships in lacrosse, and Michigan hasn't. And so from that perspective, they just want it so much more. Like a conference title to Maryland doesn't mean as much.
Yeah, I mean, I think that
no excuse, but
both teams, I think going into the game, you want it just the same. I just think that as the game progressed, Maryland looked like they kind of just ran out of gas, it felt like. And I mean, Mike, the question I would ask is, how much do you think this impacts the tournament in terms of the, you know, now that they're moving forward to looking at the NCAA side, how much does the Michigan loss maybe hinder your expectations for what they do in the overall postseason play?
At this point of the year, you just got to move on and go forward. You can't think about the last game. You just got to move on. You know, the fact that they made the championship game, the Big Ten is competitive. They lost games. They lost games early. They lost games late in the year. But they made it to the Big Ten championship. They did not win it, but they still showed that promise of potential this team could have. So they can't look back. They just got to keep going forward.
Yeah, Brendan, I mean, I would ask the same question to you. Does seeing them lose another game to Michigan now maybe impact how you see the NCAA tournament playing out? We asked if what team had the highest potential to win it all. You guys said the men's lax team. I mean, does that change what your thoughts are on it?
I don't know. Not necessarily. Like, I think I said the same exact thing last time Maryland lost to Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Maryland lost to Michigan, and they went on a three-game winning streak. I guess they won a two-game winning streak, then lost Johns Hopkins. Like, Maryland still beat very strong teams.
Yeah.
They would lose a game, and they lost Notre Dame. They'd lose a game, and then they'd come right out, and they still beat Virginia. They still beat some of the best teams in the country. It's just Michigan had their number.
Yeah, against the top teams, it seems like they've performed their best. I mean, the Notre Dame game, even though that's a loss, I mean, that's a, you know, what, three-overtime game that went into insane amounts.
Against the third-best team in the country, like, yeah.
And then Virginia is also ranked very highly, and they beat them behind a great goalkeeper performance. So, I mean, I think that this team clearly can play against the top teams. I think it's just that consistency that they've kind of lacked all season. So I think that that's something you got to look forward to, because in the NCAA tournament, I mean, being consistent is key. If you play bad one game, your whole season's over, you know?
Exactly. And so if you now looking to the NCAA tournament, the men's and women's teams are kind of in a very similar spot. So the men's team was sixth going into this week. The women's team was seventh going into this week. Top eight teams are going to host. So, you know, we won't know until tonight, which is Sunday. As you're listening to this, you'll know if Maryland has a home game or not, but either going to be the lowest seed in the probably the one or two seed, or going to host a game.
What would your predictions be for both sides?
I think the women are going to be the eighth seed, and I think the men will be a seven seed.
So you think both will host?
I do, yeah.
So then the first round. I mean,
both teams still made it to the championship.
So they would then play how many games at home, just to clarify for our audience? Do we know that in terms of, or does it change if higher seeds lose or win?
Both teams would probably play two games at home. It just depends on what the seeding is.
Gotcha. So, Mike, as we move on to the women's side, losing to Northwestern. Northwestern, a much stronger team than Michigan. I mean, Northwestern has been very good all season. When you look at this loss, it's the second time they've lost to Northwestern. Couldn't do it to win the Big Ten regular season. Now couldn't do it to win the Big Ten conference tournament. What have you seen from the Lady Terps, and why was this game maybe another either a fault of the team as a whole on Maryland's side, or was it just an indictment of how good Northwestern's been all year?
Yeah, I mean, Northwestern is the best team in women's lacrosse right now. They're the number one team, so falling twice to them in one season, I mean, it's not too surprising, but at the same time, when you have a high-level program like Maryland, you would hope that you don't lose to the same team twice.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think, Brendan, when you look at this Northwestern team, they clearly just are one of the more dominant programs in the country right now, and I think when you stack Maryland up against them, Maryland's clearly not at that level, but they're also young and inexperienced, and I think that you don't really maybe I didn't expect them to beat Northwestern in that title game. What about you?
I mean, Northwestern is incredible. They haven't lost since the first game of the year.
That's insane.
They lost by one goal in Syracuse, like, in February. They're a very strong team. I mean, going in, we talked about it last week. I didn't expect Maryland to win that game. I expect them to get to the championship.
I think you predicted.
Yeah.
No, you had the men's team and losing in the semis, correct?
But, I mean, that was pretty close there. Yeah. I mean, just Northwestern, I don't see them losing another game this entire year.
So you, that's
and
your
natty. So, yeah. And so, if you watch, I mean, Maryland wants an incredibly strong program, but had a fight for the first, you know, half.
They were close in the half, yeah.
But Northwestern is just so good.
Yeah, they just pulled ahead late. I mean, Northwestern's a very senior Latin team. I mean, they're super experienced. And it's just, I think, a lot of, when it comes to the Wildcats, I think that they've really showed all year that they're, you know, the nation's best. And if you're Maryland, when you look at maybe the tournament, that's kind of preparing you now where you kind of can see maybe how teams are now going to drop off in terms of talent. You're not playing in Northwestern because you're going to be a 7-8 seed, maybe 9 if everything goes wrong. But I think that that's something that you have to look at and maybe take as a positive as you've come out of this conference season as the second best team in the Big Ten.
Yeah, I mean, for seeding for everybody, we'll have to just see where the other conference tournaments end and then go from there. And it's possible Maryland could be end up being an 11 seed, but it's also possible they could stay at 7. It just have to see.
It just all depends, yeah. But both teams are bound for the postseason. We know.
Absolutely, yeah.
And both teams will look to make a run. I would say, do we want to change our predictions from what we thought before, or are we still going to stick with our guns on who makes it farther in terms of men's and women's?
I'll stick to my guns.
Mike?
I think I'm going to switch to women's team.
Okay. Yeah. That's who I had, and I think I will stick with the women's team. I just think that the men's team has been too consistently inconsistent, as people like to say. But team that has been incredibly consistent, I think they just extended their Big Ten series win, and that's the baseball team. Defeated Nebraska today on this day of recording on Sunday. An insane offensive performance, an 8 spot in one inning. This offense continues to be one of the country's best. Mike, what have you seen from them lately? A couple big series wins here against Indiana and Nebraska.
You are correct. Still have not lost a Big Ten series since 2021, which means they're undefeated this year in conference series. They're now 33-16, 13-5 conference record, and they have a 2-game lead over Indiana right now for the first place spot in the Big Ten. The latest projections right now, according to D1 Baseball, have them in the NCAA tournament as a 2 seed. So unfortunately, it does not look like they will host again in College Park, which...
That's a question I want to ask you, actually. If they win out the rest of the regular season, take the rest of the series, win the Big Ten as it seems like they're going to, and then win the Big Ten Conference Tournament, say they sweep the rest of the league, do you think this is a team that could rise all the way to maybe one of the last one spots, one of the one seed lines to host a game in College Park?
I do not believe so, because the committee relies heavily on the RPI rankings. So currently Maryland they are ranked...
It's lower, right? Not one of the top 16.
No. So currently Maryland is ranked 41st in RPI. The lowest seed to ever host a home NCAA regional was a 24. Okay. So they have quite a bit of work to do. Jump.
And the Big Ten isn't super strong, so there's
not
a lot of quality win opportunities, right?
Correct. But, I mean, theoretically, if they win out, anything is possible with the RPI rankings, but that is just that's a lot to go to try to host a home series. However, they are on track to win the Big Ten regular season for a second year in a row. They have a series coming up next weekend against Minnesota, who's not the greatest, and then they close with Penn State, another middle-of-the-pack team at the Big Ten. So they look like they're on track to win the Big Ten regular season. Then they got the postseason coming up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's another program, huge accomplishment. Even if they're not able to host, Brendan, I think Rob Vaughn would take a second straight Big Ten regular season title and another chance at maybe making a run here. I mean, you saw last year, you don't necessarily have to be a one seed to win a region, and I think – I disagree with Mike in that I think they could get there potentially if they were to win the Big Ten tournament title and win the regular season title. It feel like that'd be really hard to leave them off of a host from the committee's perspective.
Thing that scares me, that makes me think it's not possible to do both. Sorry to cut you off, but it's the inconsistency at pitching.
Yeah.
I think that it will be extremely hard, especially in the tournament. You have to have 1, 2, 3, 4 different guys going.
Definitely.
I mean, you were at the game today. What did you see from Jason Savkul, who's supposed to be their ace?
I mean, he's just the inconsistency's been tough to see. I think that Savvy has such good stuff, and I think it plays really well come tournament time because it's strikeout stuff, and that always plays well because when you get in jams, you need Ks. But his slider didn't look super sharp today. The fastball command wasn't great, and it didn't look as if he was kind of the dominant guy that you thought heading in. So I agree that the inconsistent pitching might play. But, Brennan, what do you think when it comes to this team potentially hosting? Do you think you can get there? And where are you at with this team in terms of what their standing is right now?
I mean, I think if you told Maryland fans 2 years ago that they would have two Big Ten baseball titles, people would have laughed at you. And so I think that's a massive positive. Do I think they'll be able to get to host? I just don't think they're going to be consistent enough. There's, like you said, maybe if they win out, which is pretty much
It's hard.
Unrealistic. I mean, they only have like 7 games left, right? And then the Big Ten tournament. Mm-hmm. If they win the Big Ten tournament in dominant fashion, I think maybe you could see it. But I think 2 seed, considering where they start, you'll have to settle with. I mean, Maryland,
especially after the start.
Vaughn said it at the beginning of the year, like, it doesn't matter if you lose the first 10 games as long as how you finish. And so we've absolutely seen that from them. And will they win out? It's unlikely. And even if they do, I think it's unlikely they get the host.
Yeah.
Go on.
I was just going to say, I agree with Brennan. I think that this team had such a poor start that that's what's going to hold them back. It's not going to be their Big Ten record because it's been good. It's been that non-conference slate where they really struggled early on, Mike. And so that's why, you know, you look at this the flip side of the coin from my perspective, that's what could hold them back. But I think that if you're a Maryland fan, you're happy how this team's playing down the stretch, even if they don't host a game.
But then it also raises a question. Why did they struggle in that non-conference slate? Because they were playing top competitors like Ole Miss, Vanderbilt. Okay, you get the 2 seed. Can you compete against that 1 seed now when you're at their home regional?
It's a good point.
I mean, Maryland's definitely hot, and that's definitely what you want going into the tournament, so you really can't ask for much more.
And what you know will show up is the offense. They average over 9 runs a game, 9.7, the top of the Big Ten. Mm-hmm. I mean, we want to talk about the record breakers. I mean, LaRusso broke the record today for RBIs in a season. Shaw last week broke the record for home runs in career history at Maryland.
The offense is incredible, and I think the bottom of the lineup too. We talk about LaRusso, Schlager, and Shaw. The three of them have been incredible. But I think towards the bottom spot, when you look at guys like Zach Orr, Elijah Lambros, those are guys who are really starting to pick up the slack and provide a little bit of pop that you weren't getting earlier in the year. Lambros is really, in particular, he's always been good defensively, but now he's starting to put it together with the bat. And I think it makes the Maryland lineup just so much more dangerous. You now have to start pitching to Shaw, have to start pitching to LaRusso, because you know that the bottom of the lineup, if they come on with runners on, they can do damage, Mike. And I think that's something that's been huge for Vaughn.
So a funny thing about their first 3 batters, Schlager, Shaw, and LaRusso, is that they're also the top 3 players in the Big Ten for runs scored right now.
I mean, it makes sense.
That's
a
pretty good top.
You definitely want them all on your team.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've been incredible, and I think that this team, when you look at the offense is going to translate. I don't think it's going to matter who they're facing in terms of pitching. I think that they'll be able to put at least 2 or 3 runs up. It's just going to come down to that, to the pitching. And I think the one good thing when you look at Maryland's perspectives for pitching is that you really start to shrink the rotation come playoff time. So now Nate Haberthier isn't asked to start. Maybe he's asked to relieve. Kyle McCoy can come in a relief spot instead of starting a game. You know, you can use guys in a more versatile role than when you know you have a Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday type series. And I think that can go to Vaughn's advantage.
Another team, one that you don't have to worry about pitching for, is the softball team. Big Ten tournament coming up. Sam, what's going on
with them?
They
play Wednesday now. It just came out against Iowa, I believe, at 4:30.
Yep.
Mark Montgomery told me before the Illinois series that they were going to need to win 5 of their next 6 to probably have a chance at the tournament. They got 3. Huge series sweep at Illinois. It's the program's first road sweep since they joined the Big Ten.
Wow.
Which is crazy, right?
Kudos to them.
So that was a big win for them. Big series sweep against the Illini. They had to have it, and they did. Blew Illinois out each game. It was actually a very impressive, probably their most complete performance. And it's not like Illinois is a bunch of bums either. They were fighting to make the Big Ten tournament because it's a limited number of teams that make it. So they were right on the cut line, and they kind of went right through them. The pitching's been incredible, though. I mean, Courtney Weiss and Trinity Schlotterbeck are both pitching ridiculously well. And I think it's just been super impressive to see both of them kind of in their senior years really start to put it all together. Especially what's cool to see is they came in the same time as Mark Montgomery was there. So he met them 2 months before the season, and then they were freshmen, you know, and then he just threw them out there. So they've kind of grown together and matured together, and and now they're kind of putting together what could be a playoff berth. And that's what I want to ask you guys. What would it take maybe in the tournament? What would you think? I mean, obviously, you know, I kind of have my thoughts, but I want to hear what your guys' opinions are on what they
could I mean, the draw is not good. Yeah. You don't really want to be an 8 seed in the tournament.
Like Northwestern?
Going after going against Northwestern, it's not ideal. I don't think they're going to be able to win that game, and so I just don't see a possibility of making the tournament. If Maryland beats Iowa, they'll play Northwestern on Thursday at 4:30, and that'll be a massive game for their season.
Northwestern's the only team in the Big Ten who's ranked in the top 15 of RPI, or top 25, I believe. They're number 6 or 9 the last time I checked. They're incredible. They've been good all year. Maryland has also not played them this year.
Ask, is that a positive or a negative that they haven't played them?
That's a good question. I would say it's a positive because I think that when you look at,
I agree.
When you're the upset team, you want as much of, you know, different variables as possible. So when Northwestern hasn't seen a Courtney Weish, although it'll probably be Schlatterbeck actually, because Weish, you would guess, would start the game against Iowa. Yeah. That's more benefit to Maryland. Additionally, you when you maybe are able to put a little bit of pressure on Northwestern, they haven't had the familiarity with you. Ultimately, I don't think it really matters that much. But I do think it's an advantage to Maryland. And I also would push back a little bit on the narrative that it's not a great draw, because while I don't think it's incredible, I think a win over Northwestern puts them in the tournament. So it's almost as if they need one really big quality win, and then they would have two top 10 wins over Oklahoma State and Northwestern. They're almost guaranteed to be in if they beat Northwestern. So it's almost like a winner, like win or go home game. And at that point, you kind of need that. I don't know if they beat the 2 seed in the tournament, if you know you beat an Indiana, if that really does as much for your resume, Mike. So I think that when you look at this draw, yes, it sucks you have to play the 1 seed if you're Maryland, but you have a big opportunity if you're even able to beat Iowa, which is a, is the first step that obviously
absolutely
you're gonna really want this offense to show up. And for some reason in Big Ten play, it has not for them all year.
No,
In the Big Ten they averaged 3.16 runs per game. However, in out of conference games they averaged 6.4. Mm-hmm. I don't know what is going on with that statistic.
Well, it's because they played terrible.
Because it's who they played out of conference, teams. Yeah.
But what would give you hope against a Northwestern is that Northwestern, Maryland has a better ERA than mm-hmm. Northwestern's pitching staff. So if you look at that, that might give you hope that the offense might be able to show out.
And also in a tournament setting, they're going to pitch Weish the same day they pitch Schlatterbeck, because softball is so much different than baseball in that you can pitch like mm-hmm. the same days, 2 consecutive days. So if Weish starts the game against Iowa, right, and they're able to take care of Iowa, which isn't even a guarantee. You know, they lost one to Iowa earlier this year. Iowa has the Big Ten's best hitter in the conference, Nia Carter, who was hitting over 400 at some point in the year, which is crazy. Say they're able to get past them, you would think that Schlatterbeck would start the game against Northwestern, but the second she runs into trouble, Montgomery's going to yank her for Weish. And I think that those two pitchers give Maryland a chance. Montgomery said the same thing to me after the Illinois game. He said, anytime we step on the field, I know we have a chance to win because of how good the two seniors are pitching. So I think that that's a huge advantage, Mike, and a good point.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible we'll see 4 teams from Maryland in.
I actually have one last thing about the softball team. Little bit of breaking news. Maybe the first in my career. Not really huge news, but Courtney Weish will be returning for a final season. She was honored on senior day, but she is going to return. And then Trinity Schlatterbeck looks like will be transferring to Florida Atlantic. Mark Montgomery tells me he said that they have a tremendous scholarship opportunity for her to complete her master's and get her degree. So it's not a thing of like she's leaving because she doesn't like it here. It's just Maryland doesn't have the avenues for her to finish her career. But
still pretty awkward to announce in season.
Oh, very awkward.
Hey, man, I'll take it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Congratulations on the big break.
Oh, huge break. You know how it is. But anyway, it'll be interesting to see. They're going to have to win, too, I think, to make the tournament. So if they're able to get past Iowa, the Northwestern game will be huge. And it'd be great to see as someone who watches all these teams to have 4 in the tournament.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially for the spring season.
And speaking of transfers who did not stay or come to Maryland, Hunter Dickinson, what are your thoughts on that saga?
Maryland just does not have enough NIL money. I mean,
how do you know that?
How do I know?
Go listen to the NIL episode.
Go listen to the NIL episode number 1. Obviously, Maryland's NIL landscape, from what we've heard, is not as great as other competitors, such as, I don't know, maybe a Kansas, you know? So I think when you look at the rosters, you add Hunter Dickinson to Maryland's roster, it would have been in my opinion, a top 10 team to start the year.
Preseason? Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Do you agree, Sam?
Okay. This is a hot take. I think Hunter Dickinson is a good player. I also don't know if Maryland would have been better with him next year. Now, I know that
that's a very hot take.
I know that might be crazy to say, and Dickinson is great. You know, he's an all Big Ten first team player if everything goes right. At the same time, I've watched Michigan basketball for every year Dickinson's been there, and I watched Maryland basketball intently last year. If Dickinson were to have come to Maryland, they would have had to change the offense to completely revolve around him. That's the type of player he is. He's going to draw in a ton of post touches. He's going to kick kind of Juju off to the side, I would say. I would have expected, I know people were saying, oh, Reese could play the, or Hunter could play the four and Juju could play the five. I don't think that was going to happen. I think Reese would have transferred if Dickinson entered. And also, you take away possessions from Jameer. Jameer's not going to have as much ball handling duties because they're going to be feeding Hunter more. Donta's going to have to slide to a more unnatural three position. I think that they would have been a more hype team, and I agree that they would have been top 10 preseason. I don't know in the long run if they would have been a better team in general. And so I know that's a hot take, but I just think that Dickinson is so overwhelming and encompassing. Great player. Don't know if it would have been the best fit.
Now, how do you think Kansas will fare?
I think he's a great fit with them. Yeah. I think that Kansas was always the obvious play for me for Hunter. I think that the NIL, the chance to work with the guy, Bill Self, who's developed elite big men. I mean, you look at Bill Self's track record of big men. Aduko Azubuike was a great player, got drafted. You know, he had Perry Ellis for a while. He's had Thomas Robinson got drafted high.
Joel Embiid,
obviously. Yeah, I'm forgetting the big one. They have a chance to win a national title. They're surround. He's got good shooters. You need good shooters to play around Dickinson because he's such a, you know, draw and kick type of player in the post. I think that it was a great fit. I think that, honestly, that was the right decision for Hunter. Even though, Brendan, I think that the commitment video was a little corny.
Now Maryland fans are back to hating him.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's too bad that Kansas is not playing College Park.
The heel turn was hilarious on Twitter. As soon as he decided... You know, let's post Caleb Swanton Rogers dunk against Dickinson and call it even though that was nowhere to be found before the post. But props to Dickinson. I mean, he drew that process out so long. He got so many attention from it.
And that'll not be the last of the kind. And, I mean, there'll definitely be more like that in the future.
Yeah, but he just parlayed it into so much. I mean, he's probably going to be the biggest name in college basketball now next year because of what this did for his brand.
Other than Bronny James, who just committed to
USC, obviously.
Future Big Ten rival USC.
Yeah, I tweeted welcome to the Big Ten, and then I realized he would never actually play in the Big Ten, but it's okay. Because he's going to leave.
Yeah.
Unless he gets a crazy amount of NIL money.
No, I think LeBron's going to want him to leave to play with him.
Also, some team is going to pick him way higher because they know LeBron is going to sign with them if they draft Bronny.
Yeah. Too bad Bronny didn't come to College Park. That would have made for an interesting trip for LeBron.
I don't know if the Nike NIL deal would have agreed with that, though.
Yeah. But Maryland basketball still, I think, is looking good for next year. You're now probably in the portal for maybe a backup big. Something like that. So we'll have to see any additions they make in the future. But
definitely not all bad in College Park. And shall we get into the final draft of the year? We've had an incredible slew of episodes here. But to reflect on them, we're going to have a draft that kind of goes with it. Here's what we got. Favorite guest of the year, favorite terrific terp of the year, favorite game of the year, favorite moment from the show of the year, favorite play of the year. And then after this, we'll round it out with our final terrific terp.
Yeah, so I think that In order to commiserate this moment, I think that we should go with the leader in the Big Ten poll in the Big Ten polls for our little under the shell conference in terms of winning polls, and I think that would be me.
That is Mr. Sam Jane.
Yeah, I think I'm last. It's gonna go Sam, Mike, and then me.
So I will start us off, and I'm going to take the most obvious game of the year, and that's gonna be the Purdue game. I think that the court storm. It's a moment that I'll always remember. Celebrating with friends and stuff, and it's kind of the obvious pick, so that's my 1-1.
Before the Purdue game, I would have taken the Gold Rush game. So
Illinois,
that's going to be my game of the year.
Brendan Weissel and Sam Jane on TV, go check that out.
Absolutely.
That was like the first game that I think that I went second, but it was the first game that I was with Brendan for, and that was pretty an electric moment. I remember
you guys
were
pretty close too, if I remember. Right
behind it was the first real game.
Yeah, remember that? Me and Brendan were going crazy that whole game as non-biased journalists, of course. But
it was a very good game.
Jameer's shot, incredible play, good pick, Mike.
Unfortunately, I don't think the next big game, UCLA, is going to make it on this list.
Yeah. So Brendan, get us with number 3 and 4.
I will take the favorite guest of the year, and honestly, came as kind of a surprise. I think it has to be James Gist.
Oh, wow. Gist. Wow. Gist.
We had a lot of incredible guests, but I mean, that was just a fun interview. Gist it was just really
awesome.
Fun.
Gist was awesome. Yeah.
And then,
right. Parlay it.
And then favorite Trivic Terp, I'm going to go with Fred Funk. I had a lot of fun doing that
one. Oh, good pick.
Fred Funk was a very good one.
Fred Funk was a great one.
For my favorite guest, I'm going to take Gary Williams. I mean, it's not often you get to talk to a Hall of Fame coach. Again, great stories from him. Just amazing.
Yeah, good pick, Mike. I mean, obviously, that was an incredible pick. And I think that when you look at these guests, we've had some really cool ones. But I will say my favorite is going to be the brothers, the boxing brothers, as my favorite Terrific Terp. Jewish Sports good Hall pick. Of Fame. Incredible accomplishments that they had. So I will take them as my pick. And then,
if you like the Jewish Sports Hall of Fame, you'll like this Rich Terrific Terp.
Let's do it. And then for my next pick, I'm going to take someone who is, I think that has just an incredible story. And someone who I've stayed in contact with, and they've been super, super impressive in their journey. And I'm going to take Noah Hansen, someone who is, you know, an Olympian, a guy who had really everything go wrong for him in life, but has not, I mean, never made like an excuse for himself, didn't make himself like, you know, a pity case. I always respected Noah. And I think that, you know, just a great guest who really, I think his personality shined through.
Yeah, I mean, that was just, again, one of our incredible interviews, hearing a great story from him. I also got a shout out Damon Brooks. That was another great interview.
I mean, we've had great so many
story. Good Ty Hatton. It was a great year.
Coach Locks, obviously. Like, there's been so many cool ones.
It's incredible, that, like, the fact that he doesn't get picked.
I think that says a lot, right? Yeah. Yeah, Brenda was great. So, like, next year, I can't wait to bring on more guests and maybe bring on some repeat guests. But
absolutely.
Enough talking from me. Next pick. Let's hear it.
Favorite Terrific Terp? I'm going to say Irene Knox.
Oh.
She could hit a target a mile away with blindfolded.
Yeah.
No, I mean, Irene Knox is a pretty obvious pick. I think that's a great pick.
That's
honestly
a great pick. Great pick, Mike. Brendan?
Favorite play of the year? I picked it back in the first round of, you know, we did this at the end of the first season, but I'm going to go back, and the Colin Griffith goal is like my first memory. I really honestly.
Brendan, just for anybody who doesn't know or needs a refreshment, Brendan saw a scrawny little freshman come in the game, said he's going to score a goal, and then, like, minutes later, put one in the net. Incredible, incredible prediction from Mel Kiper, apparently. So, great, great play, Brendan.
And then, favorite game of the year. We've all taken men's basketball, but I think just the environment next Phoenix Center, it's obvious. And then, I think the third best game, probably the Indiana game, Flash Mob. So, I'll take that one.
Yeah, good pick.
Am I allowed to double up on one game for a play?
You can take
two.
A play, absolutely.
I'm going to take the Jameer three-pointer then in the Gold Rush game.
Okay.
I think that was, other than a lot of moments from the Purdue game, that was probably the other loudest moment in the Xfinity Center this season was that three-point shot.
Yeah, good play. I'm shocked that these two options are still on the board, and I'm so thrilled. My favorite moment from the show this year was our nightly grind at NIL episode. That whole week was really, really incredible. And to be able to kind of see it all come together exactly how I thought it would, and for people to like it as much as they did, I thought it was really cool. And props to Brendan for really putting it together, but also everybody. I mean, everybody contributed, and it was a great episode. And that was a really fun night. I won't forget that for a while.
Absolutely.
And then with my last pick, I'm going to go with my favorite play. This might kind of run into journalism lines, but the Diamond Miller buzzer beater against Notre Dame. It was a great, incredible shot, and that was just a really fun team to cover all year. I was home, obviously, but I'm sitting in my dorm room watching it, covering the game, and I just remember being like, oh my God, she's going to be a top five pick. Like, you saw the poise she played with that whole fourth quarter, and now she's with the Minnesota Lynx, obviously, been balling out recently. So Diamond Miller's buzzer beater against Notre Dame will complete my commiseration of the year.
To complete my draft for favorite moment from the show, I think I'm going to say the process of just getting out our first episode. I don't know how many drafts we had of it, like three.
Five, six.
Like, every time it was like, we did this wrong, we did this wrong. We can't say we are talking about Maryland. Like,
yeah.
there was a lot that went on just to get that first episode out. But now look where we are.
That's crazy. To look back, I'm going to definitely listen to this last episode and the first episode and just see how different it is. I mean, I think that we've all come so far, and it's really just come together. And I look forward to the pod every week. And, you know, I did that at first, but even more so now.
Absolutely. And then I'll wrap up the draft and kind of wrap up this year's episodes. And I would say my favorite moment from the show was probably the Patrice Makova interview, just talking to her after just general golf stuff. Obviously, not necessarily from the show, but me and Sam were there just talking to her about a bunch of golf stuff. And it was just interesting to hear a student athlete and just
She was up there for my favorite interview. Yeah. She was incredible. I mean, just to hear her perspective, not only as a golfer, because I thought that was so interesting, but also just like the journey she had and the story. I mean, to come over from a foreign country to play golf where it's such an individual game and you can't like have teammates to kind of like rally around. I mean, her story is just great. And that was a great moment too.
Yeah. And then also, I think, got to shout out the football picks in the fall. Just very fun. We had a lot of fun. I mean, obviously, Cavett's not here anymore, but he always had a very good fun. Very good time with that. So
honorable mentions also for favorite moments of the show. I would say that anytime we did a top five and Brendan would pull out some obscene schools or anything like that.
Oh, I loved the like.
Oh, I wonder why his record's so low.
I had fun with that.
Those were great. And then also anytime Mike in the beginning when we were talking about Roman Hemby and mispronouncing it, that was just hilarious. But obviously, Mike hasn't messed up and Mike's just been. Everybody's done such a good job, so it's been awesome, and that's a great top five to end it. It's going to be tough to find images for those, but we'll make it work, and we want to hear all of your opinions again on our top five, but we have one more terrific terp to get to on the year. Brendan, take us away.
All right, we started this semester talking about the University of Maryland club fencing team, but we haven't talked about when fencing was a Division I sport at Maryland. Noah Hansen may be shooting for the 2024 Olympic Games, but Maryland's first Division I fencing defensor actually had an Olympian. That is Howard LeBeau from the class of 1977. LeBeau majored in government and politics, so like many, he chose to come to Maryland to be close to Capitol Hill. LeBeau grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, and he wanted to play for the Chicago Bulls. He wanted to play basketball. But this all changed when he got cut from his high school basketball team his freshman year. Where have we heard that one before? Instead of resting his athletic muscle, he heard fencing was a great way to stay in shape, so he decided to give it a try. He won the first couple of junior tournaments, and so his dad set him up with a private coach. LeBeau, just like Hansen, described fencing as physical chess. LeBeau says the mental skills and attributes he learned from fencing have helped him in the business world, where he has spent the last 43 years as CEO of National Enrollment Services. At Maryland, he excelled as a fencer. He was the 1976 ACC champion, two-time All-American, gained all-conference honors every year of his career, and is the sole member of the University of Maryland, sole member of the fencing team to be in the University of Maryland Hall of Fame. In 1977, LeBeau went to the Maccabi Games, where he finished second. There, he formed a good rapport with the national team coaches and joined the Israeli national team. He decided to move to Israel to focus full-time on fencing and was selected for the 1980 Israeli Olympic fencing team. Unfortunately, did not get to participate because of the boycott, but LeBeau's legacy lives on here in College Park.
Yeah, I mean, what another Jewish legend, another fencer. I mean, to be able to hear about someone like that, to kind of have dreams in basketball and then move on to another just unique sport,
fencing. Fencing is just not that similar.
Yeah, not even close. I mean, that's just incredible. And I thought when you said about getting cut, I thought he was going to turn into Michael Jordan and be like some incredible player, you know, but... That's what Terrific Terps for. It surprises every week. And it's been just an incredible ride. I want to say thank you to everybody who's listening. Shout out to everybody. Continue to follow us, though. We will be providing updates with, you know, Maryland stuff, you know, on our Twitter and stuff and things like that, under the shell, Instagram, all that. We'll be compiling a favorite moments from the show into a video format. So be on the lookout for that. And then we will be back next year. This is not a one-year thing. We'll be back, and you can continue to listen to cool interviews and me, Brendan, and Mike chat it up. So, guys, it's been an awesome year. I've looked forward to it every time, and I wouldn't want to do a podcast with anybody else.
This has been Under the Shell, and we will see you next year.